Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It's Friday, which means we take some time to dive beneath the headlines and talk about the big news of the week. And for the second week in a row, it is heartbreaking. Here's NBC News.
It was at 11:30 that the police department gets the first 911 call. He then enters the school at 11:40, they say.
That's a story that feels all too familiar.
I'd hoped when I became president, I would not have to do this again. Another massacre. Uvalde, Texas. An elementary school.
This isn't inevitable. These kids weren't unlucky. This only happens in this country and nowhere else. Nowhere else do little kids go to school thinking that they might be shot that day.
And even when it happens thousands of miles away, it still hits home hard.
We work with the Boston Public Schools, and we will be assessing whatever security measures they have in every single school in the city.
Dismissal time at the Condon School in South Boston, and parents admit to worrying about their children a little more today.
One of my parishioners said, I just can't send my kids to school today. You know, and so folks are praying with her and for her.
Sound there from WBZ-TV and Reverend Mariama White Hammond of the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester. Here on the show before that, of course, you heard President Biden and Democratic Senator Chris Murphy from Connecticut. Now, the Texas elementary school shooting came just 10 days after the supermarket massacre in Buffalo, and we are all hurting. And in moments of true crisis, we often turn to our leaders for comfort and to try to address the feelings of helplessness in order to channel that hurt and rage into something more productive. So yesterday afternoon, we invited Massachusetts Congresswoman and Assistant Speaker of the House, Catherine Clark, to join us here in the studio. And I started by asking her, how's she doing?
Pretty terrible, yeah. Actually. You know, I look across the country and the landscape, the threats to our very democracy, to women's freedom and equality, and to our tolerance of the massacre of children in classrooms, of our elders at the grocery store, of people gathering to worship. It is a pretty grim landscape in our country at this moment.
Do you feel collectively, if you look at the whole collective of the United States, do you feel we do have tolerance of the shooting in Uvalde and the shooting at the Topps grocery store in Buffalo? Do you feel as a country we are tolerant?
I think there is a huge disconnect between those in Congress who have the power to act and communities, our neighbors at home across the country. We need all people who understand that we are the only country in the world that has this problem with mass shootings and school shootings, to demand that their elected leaders act. This is the time. We are out of excuses. And to me, as I look across the aisle, if you will not act to keep communities safe, to perform that fundamental duty of your job, I don't think you deserve to be reelected and to serve people in that capacity.
Is it that raw across the aisle? I mean, I've heard some things. Okay, well, here, let me backtrack. Let me play Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy on the floor of the Senate this week.
Why do you spend all this time running for the United States Senate? Why do you go through all the hassle of getting this job, of putting yourself in a position of authority? If your answer is that as this slaughter increases, as our kids run for their lives, we do nothing.
You know, I noted that last night he had a tweet out at about 10:30 at night, then talking about trying to find common ground in the Senate, of course, with people across the aisle. And I wonder in this moment, sometimes we hear what we that common ground thing. Sometimes we hear that anger. Sometimes we see profanity from our lawmakers now directed at each other. How do we, you know what, at the 800th time, how do we get anywhere when we're that divided? And what do you think about when you're feeling that kind of anger, but you also, we got to find a way to move forward. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Exactly. And I think we see this mirrored back to us in the American people who are deeply frustrated. The pandemic has been hard. 60% of our school children here in Massachusetts have lost a loved one. 60%. And that kind of trauma, the economic suffering that people had, the loss of social connection, just compounds all the existing problems and challenges that we have to tackle in this country. But I think what we have to do is lead with community. People are desperate for it. They don't want to be told who they should hate, that they shouldn't like their neighbor. They want to find a way to come together. And what is so deeply frustrating is to see with the shooting in Buffalo that we had a leader in House Republican Party, Elise Stefanik, who wouldn't even acknowledge
from New York,
that wouldn't even acknowledge that she should maybe take down the ads that were promoting for her campaign the idea of the replacement theory. That is exactly what motivated and radicalized the shooter in Buffalo.
Now, she would argue that she wasn't promoting replacement theory.
And when she made that argument, she called those who disagreed with her grifter pedophiles. So, you know, how do we come back together? I will work with anyone who's willing to work with American families and work on their behalf to address those kitchen table issues, to make sure that we do everything we can. We know with 400 million guns in this country, it is really hard to prevent all future mass shootings. But this unwillingness to even try to block research into what tools can work, what strategies can be effective for reducing gun violence, and hiding behind the Second Amendment, it is depraved behavior. And when we have the trauma that these shootings cause, not only in Texas and in that small town, but across the country as they hear about these atrocities, we have to do better. And if you're not going to fight for families, then we need to replace you in the halls of Congress.
So a couple of questions from there. And this question is kind of forming in my mind as I'm listening to you. We know that we have a set of systemic problems that force our Congress apart, right? Our primary system brings forward candidates who are on the far ends of their parties, who then have disincentives to compromise, and we come into Congress that way. We know that's an issue. We also know there are very strong lobbies on some of these issues that are creating pressure. You said a couple of minutes ago, I will work with anybody who wants to help support American families. We also know that heading into an election in November, there are structural incentives not to compromise because you need your base to turn out, not necessarily you in particular, but in general. And I wonder in this moment, what is the countercultural step that your assistant speaker, you as a leader, other members of Congress can make, regardless of what side of the aisle they sit on? And how do we get some of those countercultural steps made now, given the incredible systemic forces that sit on top of Congress people? And then some of my listeners would, I think, would say, well, you're making excuses with those systemic forces. But we understand the reality. We've been here a while. Where does that countercultural move come from? How does it start?
I think we focus on those kitchen table issues. That is how we come together, or at least we should be able to, and draw a clear line for voters on whose side are you on. Let's take health care. You know, we have just expanded the ACA by over 15 million people. And we know that in 2017, there was a huge effort to take away the ACA from people. So you're going to work on healthcare? Are you going to work on making sure that people can access what they need, including mental health care, or are you not? And so when I say, you know, let's find those areas we can work on, that has gotten so difficult. When I first came into Congress, I was the most junior member of the minority party. And I worked across the aisle on the opioid crisis because that was an issue I could find partners with. Those people have either transformed, like Elise Stefanik, into someone I don't recognize, or have left Congress because they no longer could see a place for themselves in this Congress. And January 6th made that even worse. This party, the GOP, has become a radical party. Some of the white nationalism and white supremacy isn't just a one-off. It has become a pillar of what they campaign on. And if we are leading with fear and division and calls to violence, that is exactly what we are going to get. So I try to still work with the people who are willing to work together. But let's look at one example, the infrastructure bill, a bill that always was able to find consensus across the aisle.
The big Build Back Better one?
The big infrastructure bill, yeah, because all of these things are important to families across our country. Roads and bridges, creating great jobs, expanding broadband, getting the lead out of water. There is nothing controversial in this bill. And yet, it was seen as somehow a win for President Biden, and therefore only 13 House members on the Republican side voted for it, and then their own colleagues were demanding they be stripped of their committees, they received death threats because they voted for infrastructure. So how do we find common ground when the GOP has been so radicalized? And those members who aren't are far too often silent and complicit.
So we have a large collection of powerful Democrats in Congress from Massachusetts. You just talked about the transformation of the Republican Party. So I want to ask you, in the last 10 years, has the Democratic Party transformed? And are there things where the Democratic Party has gone too far left to find common ground as well in your mind?
I would say the Democratic Party continues to be the party of families that are putting those basic economic issues. Can you get a good job that allows you to feed your family and provide a quality of life? Do you have safe schools that are going to open up opportunities for your children? Can you find and afford childcare when you need it? Do you have the health care coverage you need? And what we're seeing is those basic issues, we have come together as a big party. We've always been a big tent party that has a lot of diversity within it, but that is our strength when we continue to come together and pass complex pieces of legislation. And no, I don't think that expanding our food program to feed hungry kids here in Massachusetts and around the country is too far left. I don't think working really hard to make sure that women and women alone have the right to make the most intimate and personal choice about having a child is too far left.
So you know those aren't the places of pushback. The places of pushback are on things like police reform and defunding the police.
I'm going to stop you there and push back on that, because defunding police has never been something that we have seen from Congress. Addressing police brutality, making sure that every mom feels the security. I worry about tons of things for my kids. But I have three white children. I don't worry about them interacting with the police. And every mom should have that security. And the proposals we've put around police reform have also been matched with making sure that municipalities have the funding they need to have police protection, to expand it. We were not, Democrats were not the ones out there saying, we don't want to fund the police departments. We don't want to help municipalities in the middle of the pandemic crisis. So, you know, I think there is a lot of rhetoric that the Republican Party uses that has been, you know, absorbed into our culture, into our media. But that is not the work that is being done by House Democrats. We are about security of communities. We are about making sure that people have opportunities. We're about reducing the cost of their health care, whether through, you know, just take the insulin bill that we passed, capping it at $35 a month. Why is that possibly controversial with my Republican colleagues?
You are underscoring another piece of the problem. And I get that this is a gnarly moment, right? I get it. You gave a litany of things that the party cares about. You know, do you have affordable health care? Do you have child care? And we know that there are a lot of people in the country right now who will say no. No, I don't. No, I don't. No,
That's
I
right.
don't. And we are in a moment where the Democratic Party controls the House, the Senate, and the White House. So if at this moment, when that's the platform, there's so much of America saying, no, I don't have that. What is the path forward? I mean, it's already all three branches.
Well, I would argue we do not have control of the Senate majority because we have a filibuster rule. So to have control, you need 60 votes. We have 50. And so until we have a majority in the Senate that is willing to change that rule to go back to when our Constitution calls for a supermajority, which is very rare circumstances, it is a 60-vote majority in the Senate, and that is why you have seen the House come together over and over again, whether it's cutting the cost of prescription drugs, moving forward on addressing climate change, building resiliency in our cities and towns and communities, and also building an economic powerhouse in green technology. Those issues are just failing to clear the Senate because the majority in the Senate, for all purposes, is 60 votes.
So I'm going to pivot us now. I mean, we could stay in that space for a really long time, and I know you live in that space, right? But I am mindful that you are a woman leader in this Congress. You've just come today from an abortion clinic, a clinic that provides abortions. I don't like to frame it as an abortion clinic. A clinic that provides abortions. Roe v. Wade is sitting out there with a leaked draft opinion. Women's health is an issue that you have been vocal on from the beginning. And I want you to tell me where your head and heart are right now.
You know, my heart is broken. Reading that opinion, it is hard to believe that we are where we are. In 2022 in the United States, we are on the verge of rolling back a major right for women, for families, for the people of this country. We have not always moved forward well, but we have never been in a situation where we are going to take back a right. And what I heard from the providers that I just came from meeting with is a true fear, a fear of these criminal laws, a fear of what will happen to themselves, to their own families, and a fear of what's going to happen to patients.
So here in the Commonwealth, at the state level, there are strong abortion rights laws enshrined. Do you think fear from local providers is appropriate? Is not appropriate, that founded. That's the word I'm looking
for. I do, because what they are concerned about is the criminalization of providing health care as they see women coming from around the country to seek health care here.
Could that be criminalized here, given who
that
we
is,
are?
That is their fear.
At the federal level?
It wouldn't be a Massachusetts law, but what will the impact be if you provide care to someone from a state that has criminalized the provision of abortion? you know, there's research to be done. We are going to look into all angles of that. But I don't think that's an unfounded fear. And we also are very aware that we are hearing from Republican leaders in Congress that if they have the majority, a federal ban on abortion is part of their agenda. We won't be safe in this case if that passes. That will impact Massachusetts as well as every other state in this country. And we have to stop and think about what we are saying. We know that women, most women who have abortions in this country are low income, they're young, and they're already moms. And if we are serious about having women in our economy, women be able to continue their education, provide for their families, to be part of our culture and independent and make their own decisions in accordance with their beliefs, their faith, that is all in jeopardy with this decision we've seen.
Do you hear from any constituents in your district who, you know, I'm always bringing it back home here. Any constituents in your district who are in support of the Supreme Court rolling back Roe v. Wade?
I do.
What do
I
they do. Tell you?
For most of them, it is a deeply held religious conviction. And I respect that. And I respect the sincerity of their beliefs. But we have separation of church and state in this country. And we have to remember that that is also a principle of our Constitution and our laws. And so I respect their sincerity and their beliefs, and I don't doubt that. But we have to make sure that we are also understanding that this is truly an economic issue. Abortion care is a kitchen table economic issue for many, many women. And as we look and are making this evaluation in the midterms of who are going to be our leaders, let's look at their support for children and moms. Going back to those healthcare plans I was talking about in 2017, 12 alternative plans proposed. Not a single one of them covered maternity benefits. Not a single one.
So let's hit a couple building blocks, just kind of in a rapid fire. So we had Reverend Mariama White Hammond of the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester on the show. And she talked about a vision in our region for a pro-child region. So top of mind, four policies that turns Massachusetts into the most pro-child state in the union.
Child care. You know, and there are many things that we can talk about, and I think that is just a perfect frame. Let's all be pro-child. If we're pro-child, we can move this country in ways, we can close these divisions, we can come together around our children. But for me, it does start with childcare and universal preschool. We know this is one of the most effective tools to fight poverty and to fight stress that we see on young kids and get them ready to learn so that they're reading at grade level by third grade, and that unlocks their education and a lifetime of learning. So childcare also is great for employers. It is great for moms and dads who need childcare so they can go to work knowing that children are well cared for. It is basic economic infrastructure. Traditional wealthy countries put $15,000 a year into offsetting costs for a toddler. Here in the United States, we put in $500. We have to keep up with the rest of the globe and understand how fundamental this is. We also have to do something about gun safety. Children dying from gunshots is now the leading cause of death for our kids and our teens. The leading cause of death. And if you add up childhood diseases, overdoses, AIDS, it is still combined. Gunshots outstrip that. And so we can't talk about these things like they're in different silos. This is literally killing our children. And it is not just mass shootings. It's suicides. It's other kinds of homicides. It's just the mass shootings are so horrific and so public. So we have to be serious about protecting our children from gun violence. We have to build a climate and address climate change so they have a future and a planet.
I want to bring us back to kids for one more minute. I have a very specific question for you on the baby formula issue. And just to give a little bit of context to the listeners who may not recall, we're experiencing a massive shortage in baby formula, according to an organization called Data Assembly. At the beginning of the month, about 43% of the baby formula supply in the country was out of stock. Right. And that is the result of a production facility in Michigan being shut down after a long process of whistleblowing and the FDA responding and then checking it out. And the conditions in the factory were extreme, standing water, leaking, lack of sanitary conditions, et cetera. Is there an accountability moment for the FDA, who got a whistleblower call in September? Didn't talk to the whistleblower till December. The factory doesn't shut down till February. We find out the safety and sanitation conditions were bad. What's the accountability moment for the FDA now?
Yeah, I mean, this is the moment. And we are having them in practically every day for hearings because we need to have these questions answered. And we need to look at how we buy formula in this country and how we ensure that it is not only safe, but that people can get what they need to feed their babies. And this particular plant in Sturgis, Michigan, it was appalling, the conditions. Children died, we believe, because of the formula that they ingested from these plants.
Although I do want to note that the bacterial signature, it sounds like, wasn't the same in the formula as what they found in the plant. Is that not correct?
That is correct. So there may not be a direct line, but there were certainly lots of warnings about this plant and the conditions. But we also have very few with the WIC program that buys 50% of the formula in this country. Families buy it through that program. There's very few suppliers. So where was the redundancy in the system? Where was the planning that if you were going to shut this down, why weren't you more responsive to the whistleblower? And what was the plan to a disruption was obvious. What was the plan to make sure there was formula that families could access to feed their children? I can tell you the panicked calls that we got in my office of just, I can't imagine anything more frantic than feeling like you might not have what your child needs to survive. And, you know, this is in the United States, in Massachusetts. We should be able to do this. Now, we have taken action. We are importing. That formula has arrived in the United States and is being distributed to what we are being told now from the administration. The shortage is alleviated and people have what they need. But there are some real questions going forward about what happened here. What are the steps we're going to take to ensure that this never happens again?
All right. As we wrap, at the beginning, you said it's a tough time. So in a sentence, what's a piece of joy that you're holding in your heart that you would share with other people?
Oh, my gosh. It always comes back to our children. And it always comes back to not only my own children and the incredible joy they provide me, but into touring schools, meeting kids throughout Massachusetts. They are our future. They're worth fighting for. And that's exactly what I'm going to do.
And that is Congresswoman Catherine Clark, who is Assistant Speaker of the House, represents Massachusetts' 5th District, which includes Waltham, Framingham, Medford, Woburn. Congressman Clark, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
We travel now to Western Massachusetts. Shakers settled in the area in the late 1700s from England and were active in the Commonwealth until the late 1960s. They're sometimes called one of the most successful utopian societies. They lived off the land, in pacifism and celibacy, in an area that now makes up Hancock and Pittsfield. The Shaker population peaked in Massachusetts in the mid-19th century, 4,000 or 5,000 members, but ultimately it dropped to a couple dozen, and when there were too few of them to manage the land, they made efforts to preserve their community in what is now called Hancock Shaker Village. The village is now open to any and all visitors looking to learn more about the Shakers. On Monday, they open a new exhibit called A Spirit of Gift, A Place of Sharing. In it, Japanese, Korean, and Thai artists explore the connection between the Shakers and Asian art. To learn more about that, we sat down with the guest curator for the exhibit, Miwako Tezuka. And we started by asking Miwako to explain the connection between the two cultures.
The affinity between the Shaker's spiritualism and aesthetic principle is more in a conceptual sphere. And I see, as I learned about the Shakers' history and their craftsmanship and how much they care about creating things around their everyday life by hands and appreciating resources surrounding them. And those are values that were very much appreciated also in many parts of Asia, and particularly Japan and South Korea and Thailand. There are, of course, strong tradition of craftsmanship, and that level of appreciation of handiwork continues to the practices of many of Asian artists today.
And tell me about the name of this exhibit, A Spirit of Gift, A Place of Sharing. What is that name? What does it mean?
So these two phrases encapsulate what we want to bring to the Shaker Village. The gifting tradition is common everywhere in the world, but when it is associated with spiritualism, there is a distinct way of unspoken a relationship that is built among people in Asia. And the second part of the exhibition title, A Place of Sharing, is really paying homage to the communal living that the Shakers conducted living in the village. And we wanted to recreate that space of sharing through sharing of contemporary art.
So let's talk about the art. Let's help people picture this. There are three artists who have been invited to participate, all creating art in different media, all weaving in Shaker culture. Let's start with Japanese artist Yusuke Asai, who is painting, and I saw a video of this, it's really quite remarkable, a mural literally using dirt from Shaker Village. And when I first saw the video, it didn't register that that's what I was watching, and this mural is gorgeous. So tell us about that.
So he is a self-taught artist from Tokyo. And as you can imagine, Tokyo is such a hyper-urbanized city in Japan. While he was growing up, he found his own unique way of connecting himself to the natural environment, where he would really stare at ground and how little insects and moss and little grasses grow and move around. And he really created this kinship with how the ground kind of fosters all these creatures. So he started to use soils to create his own pigment.
I want to explain for our listeners. I want listeners to understand these are beautiful murals on a white wall in earth tones. It does not look like somebody's smearing dirt on a wall. They're in earth tones. Beautiful pictures of animals and plants and a little bit of the pigment kind of running down the wall to help you remember that it's rooted in the soil.
Right. So it's amazing how many shades of pigments that he can create from soil he sources from different parts of the world. Usually when he receives opportunity to show his works, he would go to the location and search for the local soils. And he would ground them and refine them and get to the point where they can be mixed with water and sometimes a little bit of glue in it as a binder to create the natural paint. And he uses that to create his mural painting.
Let's go to the second artist here. This is a Korean artist, Kim Soo-ja. who has mm-hmm. created another hands-on exhibit, and this one's about thread and textiles. So talk about that a little bit.
Kim Soo-ja is a Korean artist who is known to continuously search for the connection between human labor, such as weaving, sewing, stitching, and how we actually build our living environment around us, which are often reflected in architectural designs. So Kim Soo-ja is installing two video works in the cellar level of the iconic round stone barn at the Hankook Shaker Village. And in these videos, she is focusing on the European lace-making tradition. And by juxtaposing those video works with the environment of the Shaker Village, we are trying to kind of speak to the natural richness here and how Shakers also practiced weaving and textile making. So that is the connection of Kim Soo-ja's work here.
And it is striking the way these artists are physically integrating Shaker Village into their art. Tell us a little bit now about Thai artist Pinari Sanpitak, who I understand is working with paper and the female form.
Yes. So Pinari Sanpitak is known to create a series of works in different mediums focusing on the motif of female breasts, which is in her work considered as the source of nourishment and life-giving force. So she has, for the Shaker Village exhibition, created three topiaries, which are just being installed right now in the beautiful garden at the Shaker Village. And we are growing peas and morning glories on those topiaries. And we are going to create art and food project, making a new menu, taking all the herbs and vegetables grown here in the active farm, as well as new plants that are originally from Thailand, which will be growing on the topiary.
All right. And this opens on Memorial Day. How do people visit? How do they see the art?
So when you come to the Shaker Village, you will see a sign introducing you to all the buildings that we are using for this exhibition, which include laundry and machine shop, poultry house, meeting house, round stone barn, and also the garden areas. And as you enter the garden, you will already start to see the sculptures outdoors, and you will be guided into these various buildings, and you will have some surprise encounter in different spots of the buildings.
That's Miwako Tezuka. She is the guest curator for A Spirit of Gift, A Place of Sharing, a new exhibit at Hancock Shaker Village in Hancock and Pittsfield. Miwako, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Do you know of any really cool art or community exhibits opening in Massachusetts soon that you want to share with us? Do so by joining our text club. To get started, text the word BOSTON to 617-766-0382. Again, BOSTON to 617-766-0382. For Boston Celtics fans, the first five games of the Celtics-Heat Eastern Conference Finals have been a roller coaster. We started with a real low, losing game one by more than 10 points.
A dominant second half for the Miami Heat.
But we brought it back in game two with some incredible highlights.
Quick bucket there from the Boston Celtics, a 21-point lead.
And then lows again in game three with another blowout.
Celtics have missed their first three. They started 9 for 11 from three-point range in game two.
And then a high again in game four.
White, alley-oop to Tatum! Oh, perfect pass from White, and it's 16-1.
Before in game five, we finally stabilized, putting us back on top.
Jaylen Brown with the finish! Wow!
Okay, if you're not exhausted yet from the trip, Game 6 is tonight, and it might be the win that sends the Celtics to the NBA Finals for the first time since 2010. Now, along the way, we have been following the action with Dan Shaughnessy, Boston Globe sports reporter and author of Wish It Lasted Forever, Life with the Larry Bird Celtics. Dan, welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
Nice to be back, getting ready for tonight's game.
So I'm going to start with the prediction. Do you think they're going to close it out tonight?
I'm bad at predictions, but yes, I think that I think it's been established who the better team in the series is. The Celtics are at home. They can use the rest. They have now identified the opponent of the finals, the Golden State Warriors. That doesn't start till next Thursday. For them, it's in their great interest to get this thing over with tonight, win the game, take a few days off, heal their wounds, and then go to the finals next Thursday.
Okay, I don't want to sound like I'm not a fan, but I'm going to say, you said we've established who the better team is. Have we fully established that, given what the first four games looked like?
I know, it's a weird series because there's been a 20-point lead in every game, a 20-point lead in the first half of the first four games. Very few lead changes. There's been dominance by one team or the other pretty much every day. So you haven't had great contested back and forth, up and down. It's been one team's night each time. I just think it's been established that the Celtics, they've worn these guys down. I mean, Miami's last two games, they've shot very poorly. They're very beaten up. They're on the road. They are mentally tough, no question. The Celtics have more weaponry, better players, and in my view, they close it out tonight.
I'm actually glad you brought up the Heat because you were there Wednesday. I wanted to get a sense from you for what the vibe was like there, you know, for the Heat at the end. And I noticed in your column afterward, you talked about how beat up what they were. Explain for people who may not have been following, what does that mean? Their best player,
Jimmy Butler, you know, he had 41 points in the first game, and he's been neutralized to almost being almost useless the last two games, 6 points in one game, just not a factor. He doesn't have any lift. He's got knee inflammation, and he's a tough guy, but something's happened to him. Kyle Lowry, the starting guard, he can't make a shot. I mean, their last two games, I mean, 30%, 32%. The whole starting lineup scored only 18 points. One of the guards has missed 16 consecutive shots, one of their starting guards. They're just worn out, cooked, beat down. I just don't see it. I don't see how they can rally and win tonight.
So, Dan, do you know off the top of your head roughly how many basketball games a pro team will have played in a season by the time they get here? I mean, this sounds like long-term wear and tear.
Well, you're looking at, you know, 80. Yeah, it's 100. You know, when you get through it, certainly preseason, 80, 82, and then you get into your postseason. So, yeah, they're coming up on 100 now.
And you just don't think they have the juice to pull it out tonight against?
I think the Miami, you know, they have a very worthy organization and, you know, a very, like I said, mentally tough players. I just don't think there's enough left in the tank for them. Hey, we could be talking again tomorrow and we're getting ready for game 7 and I'm going back to Miami to see that again. But I just think I've seen enough. And to me, it's pretty clear. And the Celtics kind of know this. They know, and they got to take care of business tonight. And again, like I said, it's in their interest to get it over with tonight so they can rest up for the finals.
So we are talking with the Boston Globe's Dan Shaughnessy about the Game 6 of the Eastern Conference Finals in the NBA tonight between the Boston Celtics and the Miami Heat. We will have listeners today, Dan, who are not necessarily basketball followers, haven't seen the previous games, but it's a Friday night. This is an interesting game. They're going to want to tune in. Can you give them kind of a primer on what to expect and what to look for in the game?
Well, I mean, this will be a great charged crowd tonight because, you know, you got Memorial Day weekend and there's great anticipation. The Celtics have tremendous following, great support in good times and bad. And now they have a chance. You know, this is a franchise that, you know, has won 17 championships in the NBA, was dominant in the 60s and 70s. And then the Larry Bird years, in the 80s, that's what the book's about. But it's been a while. They've only won one championship since 1986. And during this great run of the 21st century here, while the Patriots have 6 and the Red Sox have 4, the Celtics have just the 1. So 2008, they won the championship. It's the only one since 86, and there's a chance to get there again. And that's the mission, to win this game tonight, get back to the finals, and then go up against the very worthy Golden State Warriors.
A couple of times ago when you were on, we talked a little bit more about the book that you've written after spending a long time with the Boston Celtics covering them. This is Wish It Lasted Forever, Life with Larry Bird, the Larry Bird Celtics. Have you seen anything in these first five games that has changed how you would compare this Boston Celtics team? I mean, you're pretty pro the Celtics in the 80s and the experience you had there. You've said it's a different kind of game. But has anything changed in your thinking about how this team stacks up based on these five games?
Well, things evolve, and old people like myself, you can't be banging at the moon wishing it was like back then. But it was better ball then. I mean, it's been very hard to not promote this book as it was so much better to watch then. And it was. It was just more flow, more fluid, up and down, making plays, pick and rolls, give and goes. It's just a kind of a more aesthetically pleasing game to watch. Today's game, a lot more is launching three-pointers, athleticism. You don't see a lot of playmaking, no low post to the basket game. So, again, the old days, wish it lasted forever, life of the Larry Bird Celtics. And we got to know them then. We traveled with them. We flew commercial. We stayed in Holiday Inns. Now everything's, you know, there's a big moat between us and the players. That's the way it's evolved. Nothing wrong with that. But we really don't know Jaylen Brown, Jason Tatum, the way we knew Larry Bird, Cedric Maxwell, et cetera. But these are really good young players. They're 24, 25 years old. The skill set is there. And now it's their time to win a championship, which Bird did three times. Bill Russell did 11 times. John Havlicek probably six or seven times. So it's time for these guys to make their mark in this city and become the champions that their forebears were in Celtic Green.
So one last subject before we let you go. We recently had actor Michael Chiklis on, who was playing in an HBO series. He's playing Red Auerbach, a legendary previous Celtics coach. I'm interested in leadership. There is a new coach for the Celtics this year, Ime Udoka. And in the first half of the season, some rock throwing at him for the choices he was making and the way he was coaching the team. What kind of leadership are you seeing from Udoka? And sort of, you know, give us a rundown on his approach.
It's impressive. You know, he's a young guy, early 40s, was been an assistant for a long time, was a player in the league for a long time, but he was never a star player. And I think that sometimes that makes the best coaches. They see a lot of things while they're on the bench. They learn what it is to earn their minutes, and they appreciate that. And he's low key. He has the respect of the players, respect of the room, and is a defensive specialist. You'll see, you know, this stuff doesn't stand out that much statistically, but the Celtics play great defense, great team defense. He's all about that. That's the kind of player he was. That's what his charges do when they're doing what they're told. So it's his rookie year as a head coach in the NBA. Got a chance to go to the finals. I think he will. And very impressive. But it took a while. November, December weren't good. And that's when you talk about the rock throwing. And I was certainly in there with him. But since January 23rd, the switch was flipped. And they're the best team in basketball since then. And now on the threshold to get into the finals.
All right. So without jinxing anything, in our last 30 seconds, if the Celtics win tonight and go on to face the Golden State Warriors, what do we need to watch for there?
Oh, man, Warriors just have great pedigree. You know, Draymond Green, Klay Thompson, Steph Curry, three guys. This is their sixth time in the finals. Championship quality. Great coach, Steve Kerr, stand-up guy. Look back at what he said after the shooting this week and see what kind of a guy he is. And it's a very worthy opponent, and I think they would probably be favored. And probably go six or seven games. It'd be a great series, much great viewing for basketball fans.
And just for listeners, Kerr at his regular press conference refused to talk any sports. This was after the shooting in Texas, and called out gun issues instead. All right, Dan Shaughnessy, Boston Globe sports reporter. It's been fun to follow this with you. Enjoy the game tonight.
Thank you so much. Enjoyed it.
And that is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick, Amanda Beeland, and Sydney Bowles, with Sarah Leeson, Maya Schwader, and Amy Moon. Marquise Neal is our technical director. Karen Schiffman is our interim executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.